Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website MondoWeiss.net, who discusses the significance of hard-right extremist Avigdor Lieberman being appointed Israel's new defense minister. Kim Frochek, an organizer with Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project, who talks about the recent success of campaigns to stop frack gas pipelines. And Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, who assesses the opportunities opened up by Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign for America's progressive movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the midst of the refugee crises in Syria, Iraq, and South Sudan, German Chancellor Angela Merkel was the only Western leader to attend the United Nations' first World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey. The summit, which took place May 23rd and 24th, was organized by outgoing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in order to focus on 125 million people across the globe desperately in need of humanitarian aid. Expectations for the summit were lowered dramatically after the group Doctors Without Borders pulled out of the summit, declaring that the meeting was a fig leaf of good intentions, and that delegates from 175 nations were ignoring tough issues such as enforcing humanitarian law and protecting aid workers from a growing number of attacks. Oxfam's Mark Goldring told The Guardian newspaper, "Rich nations cannot wash their hands of the suffering for which they are partly responsible." Many aid groups are critical of the recent European Union-Turkey agreement on the migrant crisis and the plan to outsource EU border enforcement to troops from African nations with dubious human rights records. There was no breakthrough at the summit, and the system of international aid remains largely as it has been for decades. In the words of many observers, a system that's unsustainable. Former Austrian Green Party leader Alexander Van der Bellen won the Austrian presidential election by a razor-thin margin over Norbert Hofer, the leader of the far-right anti-Muslim Freedom Party. Hofer led narrowly after 4.6 million ballots were counted, but Van der Bellen, a child of World War II refugees, prevailed after postal ballots from overseas were counted. Hofer, a 45-year-old local councillor, ran an insurgent anti-European Union campaign for the largely ceremonial presidential post. The anti-immigrant Freedom Party won the first round of the election, knocking out both establishment parties, the Social Democrats and the Conservative People's Party. During the campaign, the smooth-talking Hofer appealed to Austrian nationalism, declaring that Islam has no place in Austria. The winning Green Party-backed campaign of Van der Bellen, a retired economics professor, ran on a pro-European platform which embraced refugees. In November, voters in Missouri will decide the fate of a constitutional amendment mandating that voters show a voter ID at the polls. The measure was pushed through by the Republican-controlled state legislature after a 10-year battle. A previous voter ID law was struck down in 2006 by the Missouri Supreme Court, which deemed it to be a violation of a citizen's right to vote. Republicans pushed for a voter identification requirement over the opposition of Democratic Governor Jay Nixon. The constitutional amendment, if approved, could disenfranchise an estimated 220,000 voters who lack a state-issued ID. Democrats, however, did win a few concessions in the legislative debate, including the right of voters to sign a ballot affidavit if they don't have a photo ID. To prevail in November, voting rights activists must overcome the perception that everybody has an ID. In racially divided Missouri, the state Republican Party condemned efforts to register black voters in Ferguson in the aftermath of the police shooting of Michael Brown. Former state senator Jeff Smith told The Nation magazine, "Missouri Republicans have been really good at equating all things Democratic with all things urban, and all things urban with all things black." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to appoint a hard-right extremist politician as his nation's new defense minister has alarmed those working for Middle East peace around the world. Avigdor Lieberman, the founder of the ultra-nationalist Yisrael Beitenu Party, was named to the post in order to add 5 new seats to Netanyahu's Likud Party governing coalition, which previously held only a 1-seat majority in the 120-seat Israeli parliament, or Knesset. Lieberman is well known for his racist and incendiary remarks made during his previous posts in government. Some of his most controversial comments include his advocating the beheading of Israeli Arabs, who he deems as disloyal to the State of Israel, the mass deportation of Arab-Israeli citizens, the drowning of Palestinian prisoners, and the bombing of Egypt's Aswan Dam. Lieberman replaces Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon, who, when he resigned, warned that Netanyahu's government had been taken over by extremist and dangerous elements, and stated that he no longer had faith in the Israeli Prime Minister. The Palestinian Authority reacted to the appointment by saying, quote, "The Israeli government sent a message to the world that Israel prefers extremism, dedication to the occupation, and settlements over peace." Your reporter spoke with Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website, MondoWeiss.net, who discusses the significance of Lieberman's appointment as defense minister and recent moves by Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign to try to change the Democratic Party platform on the issues of Israel and Palestine.
Well, it's a huge development in Israeli politics, and arguably this is sort of the most important political shift inside leadership culture, ruling class of Israel in the last 20, 25 years, in which the last defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon, quit, a pretty right-wing guy, quit the coalition saying that there were fascist trends in Israel and in the political class, and was replaced by this right-wing figure, even further right-wing figure, Avigdor Lieberman, who has threatened to blow up the Aswan Dam, who has said that any Palestinian who attempts an act of terror should have his head cut off, that kind of stuff. So he's a very crude and somewhat at times fascistic leader, Lieberman, and you have this other segment of the Israeli political class saying that the currents there are reminiscent of Nazi Germany, one said. So It's kind of staggering that this is happening, and you have also Israeli political observers speaking of this in apocalyptic tones, and some suggesting that there could even be a coup in the country against Netanyahu.
Philip, what's been the response to Benjamin Netanyahu's appointment of Avigdor Lieberman to become Israel's defense minister? What kind of ripples have moved across the world because of this appointment?
On the one hand, there's been some horror over it. Lieberman is a guy who was refused admission at the State Department last year. They didn't want him coming in because he was too polarizing a figure, who had said things like the two-state solution, we want nothing to do it, you know, we're finished with that. The political class in the United States is obviously very upset about this, but they've indicated that the special relationship between the countries will continue. You know, they're still our closest ally and all the rest in the Middle East. But among defenders of Israel, there has been a real crisis. The crisis that I talk about in the political class in Israel is reflected by a crisis in the Israel lobby in the United States. So these people who spend their lives defending Israel have been in a lot of pain lately. How do they justify this? How do they explain this to Americans? And how do they act as if Israel is fine? And some of them have been saying, this is shocking and horrifying, and we need to give the society a wake-up call, I guess. Others have said, no, everything's fine. This is Israel is a vibrant democracy, robust debate. This is just what happens over there. People disagree, that kind of stuff. So we are seeing a crisis. If you have any hope about this society reforming itself in a bloodless fashion, then you have to hope that the defense minister's resignation and the warnings about fascism could result in some real shift in the political choices of the leadership or a segment of the leadership of Israeli society.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, running for the Democratic Party nomination, had an opportunity to appoint 5 members to a Democratic Party platform writing committee. He appointed some very well-known progressive activists that included Bill McKibben, the climate change activist, founder of 350.org, Native American activist Deborah Parker, progressive caucus co-chair, Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute. Philip, tell us what the opportunities are and what you hear about the goals of Sanders' representatives on this important platform writing committee in terms of changes to the Democrats' approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Sanders set a depth charge on April 14th in New York when he told Hillary Clinton that Netanyahu is not always right. And he is determined through these appointments to put some more even-handed policy toward Palestinians inside the Democratic platform. Will it be a fight? Will the Hillary Clinton people give in on this and then run away from the platform? Who knows? But from my narrow standpoint, you have Keith Ellison, a Muslim, Zogby, and Cornel West, who are going to insist on Palestinian human rights. And that is just such a landmark and just a wonderful moment and could suggest a real shift in American political culture, because Sanders has not been defeated for taking this stand. The Democratic base has supported him. And that's key, is that young liberals in America are increasingly sympathetic to Palestinians over Israelis.
That was Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website, MondoWeiss.net. Find links to more analysis of Avigdor Lieberman's appointment as Israel's new defense minister by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Local residents in communities where frack gas infrastructure is being proposed or under construction have been joining ever more urgently with those fighting climate change, fueled by the extraction and burning of all fossil fuels. Natural gas is composed of methane, which is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the near term. These anti-fracking and pipeline campaigns, along with lower fuel prices, have resulted in the cancellation of 20 fossil fuel projects so far this year. In New York State, people have come together to fight Spectra's AIM pipeline project, which stands for Algonquin Incremental Market Project. Pipeline opponents have carried out several direct action protests recently, 3 in the month of May alone, that resulted in 24 arrests along the pipeline route. Exerting pressure on New York Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, activists won a declaration from both senators asking Spectra to stop the construction of the pipeline until more health and safety studies are conducted. Among other concerns, the AIM pipeline is being built within 100 feet of the aging Indian Point nuclear power plant, raising fears of a potential catastrophic accident. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kim Frochek, an organizer with Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project. Here she talks about the organizing that's been done thus far and how activists can use their example as a model in other fights against fossil fuel projects around the country.
So we had a postcard campaign going for the last few months to try to get Schumer and Gillibrand to make a public call to halt the pipeline and to investigate FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who approved the project of Spectra Energy. So we were so pleased. So a lot of people's moods were really elevated on Saturday because we had this, you know, piece of information that our senators and our governor and our Department of Environmental Conservation, Public Services, Homeland Security, and Department of Health were all standing with us to say, yes, we call for a halt of the AIM pipeline. Monday, we all showed up at Schumer's office, and we said, we thank you for this, but the next step is going to be that you actually have to call out for a halt of the pipeline. Like, we need the next steps of Schumer to actually utilize his power in the Senate to stop the pipeline and to investigate FERC, which is where we've been collaborating with Beyond Extreme Energy, who has been excellent in shining the light on FERC over the last several years and calling out the faulty bureaucracy of FERC and how they function by only making money from specifically the gas industry. And they're really regulated by nobody, so there's no accountability for FERC. They have an incentive to approve pipelines, and that's what we're calling on Senator Schumer, who is one of the most powerful senators in our Senate, to join together with other senators to call out FERC on their behavior against public health and safety.
Kim Fratchek, you all carried out an incredibly creative action last week when you set up a recycled 20-foot shipping container that was transformed into a renewable energy home, and you set it up right on the path of the pipeline where they were doing construction.
We halted construction for the entire morning. We were hoping that the halt would go on for several weeks. The people that were the residents inside of this renewable home were supplied with food for 2 weeks, and they had a, you know, gray water system, compostable toilet. They had a green roof, solar power, electricity creating, generating bicycle inside to charge their devices if they had to get work done, skylights for natural light. It was a beautiful, beautiful home.
So the police arrested the two people inside the container pretty quickly by cutting a hole into it and pulling them out.
It was actually very symbolic of the, you know, police department working in collusion with FERC and Spectre Energy against the will of the community and against the solutions. So watching them haul off this beautiful, recycled, renewable-powered home in order to continue the construction of the Spectre pipeline was very devastating, very heartbreaking, very symbolic. So we're hoping to basically build popular consensus where we're watching, you know, FERC and Spectre Energy basically shun our state government. They have said, Governor Cuomo has said, please halt the Spectre pipeline so we can do an independent risk assessment. Since Indian Point Nuclear Facility is leaking tritium as we speak, the pipeline right next to that is very, very dangerous. And we need to see, you know, where would this might go wrong. And FERC and Spectre both said, nope, we're going to continue. And now Senators Schumer and Gillibrand have come out and said, please halt this pipeline so we can really investigate. This is really putting the safety of 20 million people in the 50-mile radius of this pipeline at risk. This is a democracy issue. This is a property rights issue. This is a water issue. This is an air issue.
I know that FERC was found to have illegally divided another pipeline project into segments and then approved each part. But hasn't Spectre done the same thing here?
What Spectra Energy has done is they've illegally segmented the Algonquin Incremental Market Pipeline into three separate projects so that they don't have to do a cumulative impacts statement or study. And FERC has given them the green light to illegally segment this project. So the AIM is the first part of the project, which is going through Westchester County right now. And the Atlantic Bridge will be the next part of the project that will be going from New York into Connecticut. And then the third part of the project will be Access Northeast that will take this up into Massachusetts and beyond, specifically to export this to international markets that will pay 6 to 10 times more than the American market.
What's your next step?
This is a problem for our entire nation. And if we can really turn the Spectre AIM pipeline into the example of our local law taking back their power and shutting this pipeline down, I think we'll be in really good shape in order to copy and paste that tactic across the nation.
That was Kim Fratchek of Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project. Find links to more information on the group's campaigning against frack gas pipelines and related fossil fuel projects by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the days before Bernie Sanders launched his campaign to compete for the Democratic Party presidential nomination, mainstream journalists and pundits gave the independent Vermont senator's efforts very little chance of succeeding. They said his self-described Democratic Socialist agenda was out of step with most Democrats and America. There were many on the left who also believed that Sanders' decision to run as a Democrat was misguided, given the belief among many progressive activists that the Democratic Party was a captive of special interests like Wall Street and Big Pharma. In a column titled Bernie Sanders' Phantom Movement, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges declared, "The Democrats, like the Republicans, have no interest in genuine reform. They are wedded to corporate power." Despite the enormous rallies, passion, and energy that the Sanders campaign has unleashed across the country, especially among young people, it appears that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on her way to win the Democratic Party nomination. With that reality sinking in, many longtime progressive activists are asking, what's the future of the Sanders movement? To answer that question, many Bernie supporters will be attending the People's Summit meeting in Chicago, June 17th through the 19th. Others, like Socialist Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, initiated a petition calling on Bernie Sanders to run as an independent presidential candidate, possibly with the Green Party. The question of what's ahead for the hundreds of thousands of people who joined Bernie's campaign for a political revolution was discussed at the Left Forum Conference in New York City on May 21st. There, a group of activists, including Socialist Alternative Party member Shama Sawant, exchanged their ideas in a panel titled, What's Next for the Movement Behind Bernie? Here we present an excerpt of a talk by Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, one of the sponsors of the Chicago People's Summit meeting.
I just want to take us back a year. A year wasn't so far ago. A few little vignettes. One was a meeting of what we might call the non-democratic party electoral left in Chicago, which I think was May a year ago. I wasn't there. You might correct me. At this meeting, a lot of folks got together and essentially, you know, declared a commitment to fighting for more candidates like Shama Sawant, who would run and win outside the two-party system in advanced left causes. A lot of these folks were really angry at Bernie Sanders for running as a Democrat, and many of them have signed a letter, which will live in infamy, explaining to him why he was wrong to run as a Democrat. Now, given last night, where 90% of the folks at the plenary acknowledged that they were voting for him, it seems kind of crazy to look back and see how so many of those folks didn't see the writing on the wall, that running inside the Democratic Party is precisely what got Bernie so much advantage, and it's how we got socialism to be the topic at dinner tables, large and small, across the country in every demographic. That's a huge victory. So the second thing I remember is this feeling that was taking place in May and June, you know, like Bernie Sanders pretending to be a socialist and a leftist when he's really just a moderate European or something like that. One person expressed himself and said that a vote for Bernie Sanders means you have blood on your hands because his position on the Middle East isn't quite as pure as this gentleman's. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this is the United States. This is the heart of the global empire. A mainstream European politics would be a massive improvement. How can we get there as fast as possible? And yet, at the same time, his race, his near victory, is demonstrating the limits of mainstream politics in the Democratic Party. It is a fact that the establishment lined up for Hillary Clinton. It is a fact that they used the DNC or the Nevada State Party chair or whatever methods and shenanigans they could to try and tilt the balance, and he's still doing better than 40%. What that shows is not how stupid it is to fight the establishment, it's how weak the establishment is. Just imagine if we could create more battles of this scale and in state levels and district levels and city council levels where we could show again and again how weak the establishment actually is. There's such a large population in the country that has decided with their feet, with their votes, that they are going to show up for a truly radical revolutionary agenda. And they're doing it from all walks of life. One of the problems with these people is they're not quite as politically pure and experienced as we are, which causes, you know, it causes all kinds of problems. They don't know the right lingo, intersectionality. Sometimes they do things they shouldn't, like act as if they might throw a chair. Of course, they didn't throw a chair. We got to work on that. This is a huge movement. Millions of people are basically saying, okay, we're here, now what? So we have a choice. We can either tell these people how they're doing it wrong, who they ought to join, right? What the ideas are that we would like to pour into their brains, or we can do what an organizer does. Be one with them. Figure out what these grassroots leaderships need from us. Are they building organizations? Are they collecting dues? Are they founding new groups that could use our support? Are they running candidates we've never heard of before? Do they need technical help? Do they need money for us to fundraise? Do they need us to pay a little bit less attention to what we're already doing and a little bit more to what they're doing, even if it's new and imperfect? So along those lines, I would say for after this primary is over, for after the general election is over, I would say that those of us who have the most experience, and call it status privilege in the left, what we ought to do is take a look around and figure out, who are we going to support? Who do we elevate? Who do we lift up? Millennials, people of color, folks from red states, people in communities that don't have a thick web of infrastructure like New York or San Francisco or whatever. That's what we need to do. And I would suggest that one of the most important things we ought to take into consideration is that the decisions being made by these local people, these local leaders, is not going to flow from thought leaders on high down to the grassroots as received wisdom. It ought to flow from the bottom on up.
That was Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, speaking at a panel discussion at the Left Forum in New York City on May 21st. Learn more about the debate on what's ahead for the Bernie Sanders campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.